He's on my bond, Mr. Tuttle. Don't you think I'm entitled to a little fuller account? Your Honor, I called him 3 times this morning. When he didn't appear, I asked a friend of his to go to his apartment, but he's not around, Your Honor, he says. I would speculate, estimate if I have to. I would think, Judge Klonsky, he might, unwisely, have been doing some premature celebrating after yesterday. That's a guess. I see. It strikes me at once that Hobie's up to something again. Briefly, I look at Seth. He's watching both Hobie and me tensely. Judge, says Tommy, I'm not going to agree to an adjournment. The defendant knows our schedule. I'm not agreeing at all. He's absented himself voluntarily. We should go ahead. Your Honor, I don't know where Niall Edgar is, and neither does Molto. He can't just say he's voluntarily absent. Maybe there's a car wreck. Maybe my client picked a fight in a bar room. Maybe he's in a hospital or a police station. Lord, he could be a victim of some kind of foul play. His face has been all over the TV. Who knows what's happened? But it's Seth and his knitted expression that has my attention. Recollecting what he told me yesterday about his continued relationship with Niall, I finally catch on. Mr. Tuttle, whom did you send to look for your client? Caught short, Hobie doesn't answer. I think I should hear from him directly, don't you, Mr. Tuttle? Hobie looks as big and empty as a kettle drum. A hand, glistening with his manicure, loiters midair. Well, is all he finally brings out. Seth's already started forward. Mr. Molto, I say. Mr. Weissman has been a personal friend of mine for 25 years. I'm sure he can help inform the court, but only if that doesn't present a problem to you. Tommy shrugs. Suit yourself, Judge. And so the moment. Oh, it's mad, I think. Is this every woman's dream? To swear him under oath and make him speak the truth? To see if he will place her above others? Beleaguered, Seth shuffles to the center of the courtroom. What did he say? Everyone's 6 feet below me and remote? Not remote. My heart races. As he addresses me, his eyes are deep and even. With the first word, I know he's telling me the truth. He recites the story in a few strokes. The janitor led him into Niall's apartment. The bedroom was a mess. There were 2 soft-sided bags on the bed. The drawers were empty. It looked to me like he left town, Seth adds. Hobie has just lifted a hand in hopes of dashing that remark. Now we all are silent. He's fled? The words, like so many before them, leap from me impulsively. They sail into the courtroom, causing a sudden hushed consternation among the smaller group of spectators behind the glass today. Well, fled, says Hobie. He had an emotional reaction to yesterday's testimony, probably. That's how I'd assess it. I thought your assessment was your client was out celebrating. Gun down, Hobie pulls a mouth, but otherwise looks up without apology or resentment. We both know the score now. He takes the constant fooling around as his job, his duty. Tommy raises a hand. Judge, I want to proceed, he says. Come on, Hobie answers. Judge, we should go ahead. Molto has not had much opportunity to ponder. All he knows is that something is different, and given where things were going, that can't be bad for him. I'm sure he'll turn up, says Hobie. Why don't you give him a day, Your Honor? Tommy is on his drumbeat now. The defense should be forced to proceed. For God's sake, Your Honor, answers Hobie. He's my only witness. I have a few stipulations, a few exhibits, and Niall. I can't proceed. 2:00. You find your client, Mr. Tuttle. Otherwise, we're going on without him. Seth has shrunk back in the courtroom and watches somberly from the rear wall, awaiting my reaction, my judgment. Lunch, in chambers, signing orders. Annie is still clearing files from yesterday's call. Out the door, Marietta, who has brought in carryout, has skillfully deployed a napkin between her pizza slice and her TV. I remain agitated. "He's up to something," I say to Marietta from my desk. She cocks one earphone. "Who?" "Hobie." "Tuttle. What's he doing, Marietta?" She shakes her head for some time. "You know, the boy is not right, Judge. The defendant? He's crazy as a coot." We all know that. Watching Niall day in and out, you can't escape that impression. Functional, but not a mainstream personality. Eccentric. It's another trick. Like Dubinsky. Like the chemist's report or the check. Hobie can't walk a straight line. If Niall's run, who do you think told him to do it? I check Annie, who, as always, listens carefully, attempting to learn from our assessments, while she continues loading files into the steel carts from the chief clerk's office. "Probably. Only thing is, Judge," says Marietta. "What's he get? Malto's gonna kick and carry on. He's gotta know that." That's the clue. Hobie knew Tommy would demand that the case go forward. "Don't you see, Marietta? It's an excuse for not putting Niall on. Did you hear that malarkey just now, how Niall's his only witness?" "He's just trying to slow you down, Judge. No way that young fella's getting up there, adds Marietta, envisioning Niall on cross. But perhaps that's the point. Niall surely is under no obligation to take the stand, and the law forbids me from making anything of his failure to testify. But Malto's already thrown down the gauntlet. He'll point out every detail of the defense which is unsupported. This way, Hobie's got an excuse. Whatever he's up to, I'm hell-bound that Hobie won't get away with more smelly antics. When I resume the bench, the courtroom is tense. Before, without the defendant present, many of the journalists didn't even bother to come in from the corridor. Now word has circulated that something of consequence is at hand. The jury box is full, all the familiar faces except for Seth, who is probably on the street, a one-man posse. The sketchers have their pads open. Hobie and the large white cardboard boxes are by themselves at the defense table. "Mr. Tuttle?"
"Your Honor, I have to move for a further continuance."
"You haven't found him?"
"Not yet, Your Honor."
He turns his large head to the corners of the courtroom as if he might find Niall here. He'd rather not look at me. "And Mr. Malto, you still desire to proceed?" Tommy comes to the podium. "The people move to reopen their case," he says. "I want to offer Mr. Edgar's non-appearance as evidence of flight, of consciousness of guilt." He and Rudy have cooked this one up in the interval, and it's clever. The law has always reasoned that an innocent person would stay to defend himself. Only the guilty run away. Privately, the logic of this rule has eluded me. Who, having been falsely accused, would have enough faith in the system to stick around for trial? It's an assumption from a more formal era, when people lived by concepts like honor and obedience. But rule it is, age old. Hobie explodes.
"Consciousness of guilt? Any person with eyes in his head could see what went on in this courtroom yesterday. That's ridiculous, Your Honor."
"Mr. Tuttle, you know the law as well as I do. Tell me why the state is not entitled to urge the traditional inference from the defendant's absence."
"Because it makes no sense, Judge Klonsky. This case is going well from the defendant's perspective. Your Honor knows that. He has no reason to flee. None."
"Then why's he gone, Mr. Tuttle?" Hobie gasps and blusters. He might as well be a landed fish. For the first time in the trial, Tommy appears to have outflanked him. After all of Hobie's tricks, it's hard not to relish his comeuppance. He tries again.
"Your Honor, with all respect, you have to think about the emotional aspects of this case. This is pretty hard on the defendant. His mother's gone, and then he had to confront yesterday. That had to be a terrible moment. He had an emotional reaction, but that's not a guilty reaction. His reaction, I guess it would appear, was, I can't stand this. I can't handle this. Your Honor, how hard is it for you, for any of us, to understand his feeling that way?
Very eloquent, and very much what my reflections in chambers led me to suspect. Hobie wouldn't have sent Niall away without cooking up a compelling explanation, one that would make me willing to recall the bond forfeiture warrant when Niall appears an hour or so after the case has come to a close. I tell Hobie he can argue that at the end of the case. Judge, says Tommy, let me suggest that the defendant didn't like watching his father take the blame for a crime he knew he committed himself. I think that makes a lot more sense than what Tuttle's saying.
Mr. Tuttle, why isn't the prosecution entitled to make that point? Tell me why not. I motion toward Tommy. Hobie again looks around the courtroom for help.
Your Honor, you can't, he finally says. You just can't do this.
Mr. Tuttle, in my first years out of law school, I was law clerk to Justice Ringler, and one of the things he taught me, which I have never forgotten, is that the three most dangerous words in the English language are, Judge, you can't.
I can, and I will.
Judge Klonsky, please!
Mr. Tuttle, I'll give you until tomorrow morning to find your client. If he doesn't appear, we're going to proceed, and at that point, I'm going to allow the people to reopen. I will take notice that the defendant is absent, and I will allow the parties to argue the inferences that flow from that non-appearance, including availing the state of the traditional presumption that flight implies a consciousness of guilt. That's my ruling. I drop my head decisively.
No more bullshit. No more playing chicken.
Furious with me, Hobie stands before the bench, rowdily tossing his head.
Your Honor, if you allow them to reopen...
Mr. Tuttle, there is no if. I've ruled.
Judge, I'm going to have no choice but to move for a mistrial.
It's as if the world has divided right in front of me. What did Seth say about Hobie? He can't get over himself? Intent on having his way, he seems not to have noticed how angry I am. And of course he'd never sense how welcome the opportunity is which he's presented. Without a mistrial motion by the defendant, double jeopardy requires the trial to proceed to conclusion. But Hobie is claiming that by allowing the state to make hay from Niall's absence, I've so prejudiced the defense that he'd rather call the trial a washout and start over from scratch whenever Niall turns up. I can feel the courtroom trained on me, aware I've grown unusually still.
Your motion is allowed, Mr. Tuttle.
Utter stillness. Across the entire floor, in all eight courtrooms, it seems to be one of those breathless moments in which no one even moves. Hobie stares up at me, searching for a clue as to what he must do now.
Judge, I'll withdraw my motion.
I just granted it.
Your Honor, I said I was going to make the motion. It was what I was contemplating for tomorrow morning. I didn't make the motion.
Your motion is deemed made and granted.
Then I move you to reconsider. I move you reconsider and take a day to think about it. I offended Your Honor, I can see that. I apologize humbly. Humbly, Judge Klonsky, but please reconsider.
And so I reconsider, but only momentarily. In some part of me, I will always be sitting up here in judgment of myself, speaking out for my beliefs, fearing my own weaknesses, struggling with my past. Objectivity is, at best, a matter of degree. But after all the strange outside forces that have buffeted me, after Brendan Toohey and Seth, after Hobie himself and his antics with Dubinsky, I'm no longer in the comfort zone that passes for impartiality. Probably, I should have known to start I'd end up here. I would go on if I had to, but I won't. I can't let this opportunity pass. It's the saddest thing in life to make the same mistake twice.
Mr. Tuttle, this case is over. And because I have presided as the finder of fact, it would be inappropriate for me to hear the case again. I'm going to send it back to Chief Judge Toohey for reassignment. That will be the order of the court.
Your Honor, says Hobie in final desperation, please,
don't be like this.
I don't bother with a response. Malto looks dazed. As I stand, he finally wakes and comes to the podium to make a motion.
People move to forfeit bond.
Sallow little man, always lit by the eternal candle of one unending hatred or another. He is asking for Loyal Edgar's house. I retreat to chambers. For an hour, the phone rings constantly, distracting me from the silence of my two court officers, who both clearly believe I lost my temper or my mind. Marietta handles each of the calls the same way.
Judge, don't give interviews.
She bangs the phone down. Any moment now, Brendan Toohey will be on the line. But as I busy myself, I am jubilant. Free. Not of responsibility.
But what greater gratitude can there be than to have been accidentally saved from our errors?
Near four, I decide to call it a day. In the spirit of the season, the court deputies have hung a wreath over each of the metal detectors. As I am passing on the outer side, I catch sight of the haggard figure of Tommy Malto, also heading out. We arrive at the single exit at virtually the same moment. He apologizes for the bond motion. I did not even rule, only glowered before stalking off the bench.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, he says.
We were all in quite a state.
So what do you figure, Judge? Think Tuttle sent him to the woods so he'd have a reason not to put him on?
That's one of the guesses downstairs.
Proprieties, judiciousness survive the case. I reply with an inscrutable fanning of my fingers as if such a thought had never crossed my mind.
Rudy thinks he did himself.
Really?
This alarms me.
Any reason?
He's a screwy kid, hell. Kid, Tommy snorts.
Past 30. He'll turn up, that's my bet.
We'll see, Tommy.
It's a strange development.
I'll say.
You did a good job with what you had.
I tell him his direct of Edgar was classic. With the compliment, he lights up like a little boy. Poor Malto, so seldom praised. The case was well tried on both sides.
I tell Hobie that too, but I don't expect he'll ever speak to me again.
Tommy looks off, rather than show much.
He got under my skin, he says, and shakes his tight, tired face about.
When he looks back, he's gripped by a different thought.
Why'd you do it, Judge?
The mistrial?
It was the right thing, I say, given all the circumstances.
Sort of made my day.
He laughs at his willingness to settle for a tie.
I thought I was going to win this case when we started.
Maybe next time.
He laughs at that thought, too, the same self-deprecating little huffing sound.
It won't be me. They can play monkey in the middle with somebody else, he says,
and again considers the distance. After a second, he says,
probably not anybody. Can't put hardcore on again, or the father. Not that I believe all of Tuttle's stuff, I don't.
I think the kid is wrong, Judge.
You didn't prove it, Tommy. We've arrived at the moment of candor we both wanted. He hitches a shoulder.
I got out with my boots on. I appreciate that.
I've been so focused on my own fortunes, I haven't considered anybody else's. They're all winners. The PA's office, even Niall, who apparently will not be retried.
Maybe Hobie, too.
A fear strikes me. Brendan Toohey may like this, may compliment my diplomatic style. Then, of course, there's Edgar. He's still as ruined as he was at the start of the day. I'm glad for your sake, Tommy. It's nice somebody's a hero. Tommy, in an ironical, reflective mood, just shakes his head. It's a bitter thing for him, I guess, this system. I understand. Practicing, I had days when it did not seem there were rules at all, just random results and rationales composed after the fact.
Hero, he says.
You know what I am? I'm the chump.
I'm the poor so-and-so who just does his job, who goes down to the factory every day and busts his butt, and then comes home and gets sassed by the kids and nagged by the wife. I'm just doing my job. That's all I've ever done. Try this case, Tommy. Okay, I'll try it. I read the reports, I talk to the witnesses, I come up to court. What they're doing or thinking downstairs, I don't begin to fathom. I never was a politician. That's my problem. I don't think their way. These guys have got wheels inside of wheels. You know, they're sitting in the back room with the PA having skull sessions, drinking single malt scotch after hours, and getting excited trying to figure what everybody else is really up to, and how much of what people say they ought to believe. I don't know. I don't know about that stuff. I'm just up there trying the case. They think I don't know I'm the burnt offering. They sent me up there to lose that case. I know that. I've known it all along, but I was up there anyway, trying to win. He gives me one further penetrating look, someone who knows he'll never be rescued from himself, and moves ahead of me, into the air growing brittle with the touch of winter. Then I go on with my life. I bring Nikki home. Near 6, the phone rings. Seth. He sounds as if he's in an airport or a train station. There is clatter thrown down from some huge space, drowning his voice. I'm not going to make it. Oh? Don't think it, I tell myself. I want to reach inside my chest and grab my heart. I'm at the hospital. He takes a breath. Niall? That's my next thought. My father had a stroke, he says.
Oh, God.
Sarah was with him. They'd finished their stuff. She went to make him some soup for lunch, and when she came in, he was on the floor. He was actually gray when we got him here.
How is he?
Not good. He's not quite dead. The word I keep hearing is linger.
Seth, I'm sorry.
Nikki, at the mention of his name, runs in from the den.
I want to talk.
I spend a second shushing her, but Seth tells me to put her on, and a minute passes with them gabbing about the teeth he sent her. The trial's over, I say, when she hands back the phone. I saw it on a TV in the ER. The pre-recorded robotic voice of Commerce interrupts, demanding more change. A coin rings through. Afterwards, there was no more about the trial from either of us. I realize there never will be. There's only one real question.
Are we okay?
He asks.
I think so.
'Cause look, I'm a straight guy. It's a pretty short list, you know, what I can say for myself. But that's on there.
I'm sorry, Seth. You caught me by surprise, but I know you didn't deserve that.
I want you to trust me.
I'm going to try, Seth.
All right. Well, I have to get back to Sarah. We both wait, trying to figure out if there is any more to say. But there isn't. Not right now. We have time.
Part 3. Judgment. The 60s are often regarded as a storm that came and passed, a cyclone that blew through, its damage long repaired. But among the era's more enduring legacies was establishing a style of youth, of being young, that's been passed on for 30 years now by example in an endless chain of kids. Whether it's matters of speech, using the word like as an article, or the omnipresent man, or the torn jeans, the shoulder-length hair like Spanish moss, or the hazards of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, we develop rites of passage of a surprisingly enduring nature. Listening to my daughter, I often feel a little like the American natives who puzzled as Columbus told them he'd discovered a new world. Which only goes to augment the fundamental boomer dilemma. Unable to reform the world, many of us decided to have families in hopes of creating a more perfect order at home. We didn't want children so much as allies. Thus, the 60s became the 90s, tied together by the motif of child worship. And, as a result, there can be no generation more thoroughly unprepared for the inevitable discovery that we've become our parents. Michael Frayn, The Survivor's Guide, May 16, 1990.
April 1st, 1996. Sunny. On a spring morning, so fragrant and perfect that winter, ferociously present only a few days ago, seems a stark impossibility, Bernhard Weissmann is laid to rest. Gathered for the graveside service is a small party, no more than 30 or 35 persons, on the rows of folding chairs placed over the soft lawn. Mr. Weissmann had no siblings or cousins, none that survived, and he has outlasted his contemporaries. He was like Ishmael, but the people whom Sonny knows Seth and Sarah want are here. Lucy has flown in from Seattle, Hobie from D.C. Lucy and Sarah both stayed at the old man's house last night, preparing for the visitation, the Shiva, which will take place there after the ceremony. Seth was with them past midnight, cleaning, pushing around the furniture, looking through his father's papers, remembering if not reminiscing. This morning, so that the three of them had a final, private moment at the funeral parlor, Sonny took over, stopping at Mr. Weissman's to plug in the coffee urns and receive delivery of some trays. Then she raced through traffic to the service, only to find it had commenced seconds before without her. The casket, a plain pine box with a Jewish star, the economy model, Seth called it, sure this much would meet his father's eternal approval, stands on a steel contraption over the bleak opening in the earth. On either side, the grass has been peeled back and the mounded soil heaped over the small granite stone that carries Dina Weissman's name. A few clods have tumbled down and touched the shoes of the front row mourners, Seth and Hobie sitting stiffly, Sarah weeping with her mother's narrow arm around her. From the distance, Lucy appears as Seth has described her, still very much the figure of a girl, small and slender in a black sheath and flat shoes. Her tiny freckled face, observed at various angles, is chafed at the nose and puffy with tears. Officiating at the graveside ceremony is Rabbi Herschel Yanker of Temple Beth Shalom, who Seth says presided at his bar mitzvah. Seth portrayed him as a cranky, fulsome character, but Sonny finds the rabbi's round tones and eyes-clenched transport in prayer to be somewhat soothing. Eulogies are offered by Seth and Hobie. Each talk is heart-rending, forthrightly emotional and honest to the core. Neither man pretends the old man was sweet or kindly. He was fierce, brilliant, immeasurably and inarticulately anguished by the evil he had survived, and the incomprehensible conspiracy of forces which had allowed that to occur. More clearly than ever, some sense of the way torment has traveled between generations invades Sonny, and throughout the eulogies, she, like a number of those present, finds herself in tears. She thinks alternately of her mother, and also of Seth, a good person, she feels, truly a good man, yet, for all his privileges and success, tortured at moments. As the ceremony ends, he makes his way to her, palpably uncomfortable in his dress-up clothes, his blue suit and his white shirt, his tie a bit too narrow for current fashion. The new beard he's grown, which adds an element of conviction to his appearance, has filled in everywhere now but the hollows of his cheeks. He holds Sonny at length. "What I'm trying to figure out," he whispers, "is if I'm free now or damned forever." Some of both, that's what she knows, but he'll find out on his own. He moves off then to the funeral home limo that will take Sarah and Lucy and him to his parents. At the curb, Lucy, still weeping fiercely, is hugging Hobie's parents, whom she's known forever. Seth takes his wife's elbow to help her into the car. Sonny has yet to speak a word to Lucy, and isn't looking forward to it either. No matter how sage or life-rumpled they pretend to be, it will be awkward. She doesn't know exactly what Seth has said to his wife about their relationship. Seeing each other, probably. That wonderfully vague 90s locution. Of course, she doesn't know precisely what she'd say herself. Often, at the smallest moments, Sonny feels as if Seth and she sprang from the same soil. The 25 years, an entire adult life in which they did not really exist to one another, occasionally seemed to have inexplicably steered both of them into the same estuaries of habit. They each subscribe to The Nation and Scientific American. Both crave strawberry frozen yogurt and pad thai. Often some forgotten fashion or event of the bygone decades comes up. The Chrysler bailout, pet rocks, Wilbur Mills, quarry tile on kitchen floors, and they will respond with identical remarks. Exactly, they are always saying to each other. Yet overall, there's a distance to travel. Guarded is the word she'd use in assessing the present temper of their relationship, certainly on her side. She's heard that about the second time around. Either you make the same mistakes all over again, or at every moment, labor not to repeat them. Last month, Seth did a column on two tightrope walkers. They made it sound like Zen. You keep your eyes forward. You believe the rope will be where you place your foot. That's their life together at the moment. Counting the trial, Seth has remained in Kendall County for more than 16 weeks. But his father's condition, which seesawed dramatically for 4 months, has allowed both of them to avoid any clear declarations. He sleeps at Sonny's usually, and made a point of being there last night, but his clothing's at the Gresham, where he goes each day to write his column. The paper pays for the room anyway, he says. Yet she suspects he'd move in lock, stock, and barrel if she suggested it, which she won't until she's really sure he'd stay, and that she wants him to. Shining black, the mortuary's stretch Cadillac lumbers off, trailing exhaust. Sunny's heels stick in the soft lawn as she makes her way to the minivan alone. Outside the old man's house at the top of the concrete stoop, Sunny finds a pitcher and bowl placed on an old-fashioned TV table with fold-away aluminum legs. To wash away the soil of the graveyard, Stu Dubinsky explains as he comes wheezing up the stairs. His belly, the size of a large globe, parts both his suit jacket and his overcoat. Inside, taking her wrap to Seth's old bedroom, Sunny spies Sarah. She's in her grandfather's study where old Mr. Weissman privately surveyed his account statements and brokerage confirmations, locking the door even when he was alone. Sunny, who has not had a moment with Sarah yet today, enters. Turning from her grandfather's desk, Sarah throws her arms wide to Sunny, her face again a mask of grief. She is a terrific girl, possessed of all the gifts, sincere, sober, if sometimes frenetic with her many commitments, everything from varsity volleyball to teaching English to Russian immigrants. Often when she has shown up at Sunny's on Saturdays after visiting her grandfather, she confesses she hasn't slept. In private, Sunny wonders if Sarah somehow feels obliged to accomplish everything two children might. On the desk, where Sarah was occupied, a toy of some kind stands, not fully constructed. A castle?
It's a three-dimensional puzzle.
Sarah displays the box cover.
We worked on it last night, my folks and I. Whenever we're together, the Weissmans do puzzles, Sarah offers with a somewhat hapless smile. Isaac was awesome.
She turns and fits a piece into a jigsawed opening along the parapet. The image of the three of them, Lucy, Sarah, Seth, working here at the roll top, comes to Sunny clearly. The metal desk lamp, with its old-fashioned beetle shell head and flexible coiled arm, was burning. They seldom spoke, but each of them knew what they were doing and did not care. They needed the union, the memory, the way Isaac lives when they are together. Sarah offers a handful of the foam plastic puzzle pieces to Sunny, but she has a strong reaction. She could no more touch them than the dead boy's bones. In the kitchen now, Lucy has taken charge, giving directions to Seth and Hobie and Dubinsky, who've all removed their jackets, rolled their sleeves. She addresses Seth as Michael, a habit born in their paranoid, terrified Dodger days in the early 1970s, when Seth's freedom depended on making no slips. Seth married with that name. Sarah's birth certificate still reads Sarah Frain. The practice seems a little precious now, a boast about the excitement of the past, and yet Sunny has heard herself occasionally calling Seth baby. What's in a name? That old question. She will have to be sure to call him Seth today. Sunny asks for an assignment, and Lucy, busy at the sink, says it's all done. She turns only as an afterthought, and when she sees it, Sunny cries out, "Oh!" and instantly rises to her toes to embrace her, tugging at Sunny's neck and saying how wonderful she looks. Lucy smells of various herbal scents and feels much stronger than Sunny imagined, given either her size or Sunny's memories of her as a girl. The house fills. Several neighbors filter in, a few elderly friends of Seth's mom. Lucy's brothers and their families arrive. Sarah's boyfriend has led a group up from their residential house at Easton. Alert young people, they stand about together, the girls noticeably better dressed than the boys, all somewhat at a loss for the proper gestures. Sunny spends time with Hobie's parents. They are spectacular, warm and funny, wise with age, one of those perfect couples everyone dreams of being a part of. Now well into their 70s, they are each overweight and arthritic, but still sharp. They tease one another constantly. Then Solomon Oguro and Marta Stern, who have both taken to Seth, come in, and Sunny passes time with them. Across the room, Sunny catches sight of Jackson Ayers. What's he doing here? She never gets the chance to ask because the publisher of the Tribune, Mas Fortunato, arrives, joining Dubinsky and a group of his executives who've been here for a while. They've been courting Seth for weeks, hoping he'll make the Tribune his home paper now that his contract in Seattle with the Post-Intelligencer is about to expire. In the last 2 weeks, Seth has had interminable phone conversations with his lawyer in Seattle, Mike Moritz, every night. Across the living room, Sarah, who's been summoned to receive Fortunato's condolences, casts Sunny a desperate look, and Sunny begins searching around the house for Seth. Through the dining room's bay window, she finally spots him, touring the perimeter of the small backyard with Lucy on his arm. Seth and his wife arrive at the far corner where his father's narrow barnwood shed stands. From somewhere, Seth produces a key, and for a moment the two slip inside. In the fissures between the planks, Sunny can detect motion like figures glimpsed through the trees. She has the wildest association. Long ago, one Sunday afternoon in California, when they'd gone apricot picking, Seth wanted to screw in the woods. From the grove 100 yards away, Hobie, stoned as always, singing Sunny Afternoon at top volume, along with a phonograph booming from a window, suddenly spotted them, naked as creation. He cried out, "Nymph! Satyr!" Grabbing her clothes off the twigs and leaves, she ran away, shamed and angry. She wonders if it would work to cry out the same thing now. Instead, when Seth emerges from the shed, he's wearing a plastic watering can on his head and Lucy's laughing. For her amusement, Seth tries it on again with the spout over the other ear. He has almost none of that frivolity with Sunny. It's there all the time with Nikki, but she wouldn't have even known he could share it with a grown-up, let alone another woman. "How you doing?" She marks the voice behind her as welcome before she turns. It's Hobie. "I've had better moments. We all have." His tie is dragged down, and he looks even bigger without his jacket, the white shirt stretched across his upper body reminiscent of the skin over a large drum. She can smell his cologne, the same scent that traveled with him when he came to the sidebar during the trial. "Are we on speaking terms?"
"Hell yeah, I'm off duty."
"You do your job, I do mine. That's how I look at it."
"Me too."
"Mind," he says, in the same intonation she heard half an hour ago from his father, "I didn't say I don't care. I do. Or that I agree. I don't." "I heard what you said. I can pick on you too, you know. I had my reasons and I'm not apologizing." Sunny has spent little time reflecting on the trial. The principal sensation in memory is one of grateful escape. Niall Edgar by now is one of the thousands of younger people who pass before her, headed for moral oblivion. There is no figuring anyway what really happened. Everybody was lying. She knows that much. Once that starts, you can never tell. For her, the trial is one more conquered portion of the past. In some ways, she feels it was only a prelude to other things, to something firmer in herself, to this time with Seth, and also, of course, to the cautionary tale he finally related to her so abjectly about the crazy events of 25 years ago, the kidnapping. Cleveland's death, Michael Frayn's disappearance. He says he's tried at times to write it all down for Sarah, as if that might abate his anger at himself and Edgar, both of which somehow remain alive to him despite the years. She glances back to be certain Hobie has been subdued, then tells him how touched she was by his eulogy. His large shoulders move.
"I talk," he says.
It was more than talk.
"I suppose. You know, I always figure if my mama was just your average Black Baptist lady, I'd have been a preacher. Maybe better off than I am with the law. Being Catholic, however, I found clerical life lacked a certain fundamental appeal."
He clears his throat and they laugh together. Sonny has no religion. It was another of Zora's subjects.
"The great swindle," she called it. "Human beings on bended knee before pieces of wood, using their last potato to hold the candles even as they starved. The Inquisition, the Crusades, war upon war. More evil," Zora maintained, "had been done in the name of religion than any other force in human history. But today, in that gathering at the cemetery, standing, sitting, listening as many chanted with the rabbi in that ancient tongue, a language which to Sonny has always sounded like the voice of mystery itself, she had some sense of the majesty of spirit which the ritual is meant to inspire. Not that she could ever yield to it. In her own terms, she can think only of woodland moments, mountain views. But she would like to leave this door open for Nikki. Until the old man's death threw things into commotion, Sonny had been talking with Sarah about holding a Seder at Sonny's house this week. She wanted Nikki to be exposed to a religious ceremony of some kind, and Passover, the festival of liberation, is the sole Jewish observance Seth seems to enjoy. Meanwhile, Hobie emits a ruminative sound. He's finally caught sight of what attracted her outside. "So what do you think, Hobie?" "I don't think he stands much chance in the Easter parade."
"And what about me?" she asks with sudden daring. "What kind of chance do I stand?" She's a bit shocked by herself, not by the pained tone, which is genuine, but because she knows there's an element of folly. Seth would ask exactly the same question about her. "What chance do I have?" Then, too, this could be taken as prying. Seth and Hobie are on the phone every week or so, having those weird guy talks, half an hour on basketball and then out of the blue, almost as if they hope neither notices, the most heartfelt intimacies. But Hobie turns from the window, looking as puzzled as she is. Large and solemn, he places one hand on her shoulder.
"Only thing I know," he says, "is there ain't a tougher guess in life than love."
Seth. Edgar's got brass clackers, but I don't see even him pulling this off. Coming down the hall, Seth recognizes Dubinsky's penetrating nasal tone. "Turn a fucking street gang into a political organization?" Stu asks. "That shit went out with Hobsbawm." Seth has just spent a minute with Sarah in his father's study. She was suffering intensely, revisiting all the losses of the recent years. His daughter is learning the hard lessons of a giving nature, that great passion means great pain. Entering the light and noise of the gathering, Seth is amazed to see that Stu's addressing Jackson Ayres.
My condolences," says Jackson and falls forward for Seth's hand. It didn't even strike me Bernhard was your father. You see how doggone funny these things are?
It turns out that Hobie's father had introduced Ayers and Mr. Weissman long ago. Jackson received investment advice from Bernhard for decades and speaks warmly of him, which Seth supposes means Jackson made money. The last time Ayers and Seth met, they were in their own professional modes during Niall's trial. Introducing himself as Michael Frayn, Seth had proposed an interview with Hardcore. Ayers had stared with unapologetic hostility and walked away.
"I told you I remembered you," Seth says. "You lived on the other side of U Park."
"I lived on the black folks' side,"
Ayers replies, a piece of revisionism that neither of them fully believes. In the 1950s, the Negro professionals in U Park simply thought they'd finally crossed the river to the real America.
"You were always in Gurney's kitchen. That's what I remember. I remember you fine."
Limber in spite of his age, Ayers, with his snowball pomp, draws back, the better to eye Seth and to reflect on whether he's gained any advantage with this display of potent memory. He wears his burgundy sport coat, shiny at the shoulders, and an old paisley tie.
"See, what got me confused is the name, you know? You weren't Michael Frayn when I knew you. Can't have been too happy to be your daddy's son. Not if you lived your life with someone else's name. Guess you just got sick and tired of being Jewish, huh?"
Startled, Seth actually laughs out loud. In all these years, no one has ever suggested that motive before. He is tempted, in his present melancholy, to surrender to a mood of self-accusation, but he finally screws up his face to disagree. Ayers goes on, though, certain he's right.
"I've known a couple of Jewish fellas over the years who done that. One bird I went to law school with. What was this rascal's name? Abel Epstein. He became Archibald Van Epps. Can you imagine? Envied him, too, I must say. Now and then. Don't you look at me like that. Hell yes, I'd change my name and be done with it. You damn right I would. I'm not afraid to say it. Only thing is, black men can't do it, you see? Whether I call myself Tyrone or Malcolm X or Step and Fetch It, still some white fella gonna see me coming three blocks away. Half of them afraid I'm what I am, and the other half afraid I'm one of them hoodlums I represent. Ain't gonna change for centuries. Centuries."
There really is no arguing with him, Seth knows. Jackson's been thinking about this one subject, race, his entire life. It's Dubinsky who rescues Seth. Always on the beat, Stu wants to talk about the trial, hoping to catch Ayers in an unguarded moment. It wouldn't occur to Stu this was out of place. Ordinary lives, even in their tragic instance, are second-tier events to him, inherently less worthy than the news.
"It doesn't make sense politically,"
he tells Ayers, returning to their quarrel about Edgar.
"Is the governor gonna release Ken L. from the pokey one morning and meet him for breakfast the next? It's not possible. It never was."
"Can't say about that, you see. All you journalists," Jackson gives the word a derisive turn, "you all are just professional Monday morning quarterbacks."
In his humorless confrontational mode, Jackson rises to the balls of his feet, looming over Dubinsky. With its abrupt and unsatisfactory ending, the trial remains the subject of gossip. Everyone has theories about where Niall went and whether he is alive or dead, and who might have killed him, about Edgar's role in the crime and his future in politics. One piece, Dubinsky's, Seth thinks, said Edgar would not run again. Oddly, however, what Seth hears about the case, he overhears almost as background noise, much like this conversation he's happened upon. No one speaks to him directly. Sonny, Hobie, Dubinsky, they all have secrets, ruminations they won't disclose. On his own, he has occasional fantasies of encountering Edgar on the streets of Dusable. Perhaps they'll stare each other down, or Seth will resort to violence, or they'll have a terse but complete exchange in which they finally finish their business after all these years. He thinks less elaborately about Niall, but wonders often if he's safe.
So, you think Edgar was on the level?
Dubinsky asks.
See, to me, this whole case, something's wrong. My editor's like, give it a rest, but you know, there's just that basic Kendall County aroma here.
Dubinsky, Seth thinks. He lays down the best dish in this burg. You read it, you think, holy smokes, maybe it really is like that. But it isn't. Seth would love to live in Stu Dubinsky's world, believing all evil is the result of bad old men hatching plans in back rooms and corner taverns. It would be wonderful if people were actually that powerful, if chaos was not the predominant force in the universe. But Seth's learned otherwise. You stop on a street corner, and 30 seconds later, the little boy beside you is dead. Listening to Stu now, Jackson Ayres chortles in audible disbelief.
No? Asks Stu. So then how was it?
He takes a step closer. But Jackson has played dice on too many corners. He's been hustled by better than Dubinsky. He simply shakes his head.
I tell you how it was. Same as it always is. My client's in the penitentiary serving 20 years for murder, and the white fella's running round loose. That's how it is.
Jackson again briefly flexes upward to his toes, and then, to dispel any doubt about the injustice of all this, adds,
If that boy wasn't guilty, you're gonna have to tell me why he run.
With that, Jackson breaks off, and Seth goes too. He briefly joins Sunny with her friends, Solomon and Marta. Marta is enormous with child and radiant about it. Even in the spring, the heat of a crowded room is too much for her. When she embraces Seth, her cheek is damp. Seth receives their condolences, then moves around the living room thanking others. Dick Burr, one of the honchos from the Tribune, is here, a decent guy, out to woo Seth, but earnest in his consolations. Burr says Dubinsky gave him copies of their eulogies, which they're going to have typeset for Seth at the paper. Together, Burr and his assistant Fortune Real have been speaking with Lucy's older brothers, Douglas, known as Deke, a banker, and Gifford, a manager of pension funds. Both live in Greenwood County and are members of an endangered life form, the high-born wasp. Seth is enormously fond of each. They have shown unflagging loyalty and good humor through the years in the face of Seth's columns about their lime-green slacks, their boats and exclusive clubs, and their slavish, sensual attraction to alcohol, which each man experiences as the open sesame to the universe of emotion. As Hobie's parents make ready to depart, Seth crosses the room to embrace them again, then stands outside on the stoop, seeing them off. Afterwards, he faces his father's small brick house alone. What a strange business this is, he thinks. Inheritance. Owning the walls you once wanted to escape. He looks through the poor glass of the storm door to the tiny entry, the dim, fusty halls, which his father, in his penny-pinching foolishness, did not repaint in 40 years, have now acquired a museum quality, as if some special meaning arises from the simple fact they were preserved. He comes down the stairs, feeling a sudden urge to make a proprietary survey. Daffodils are sprouting in the weedy bed on the south side, next to the tiny cellar windows, which in childhood reminded him of his own mouth, with its gapped teeth. It is that magic time in the Middle West. In the distance, the trees are stark and bare, but up close, one sees the branches heavy with sensuous buds. A day or two of warmth, and the green explosion will occur. The air will be sweet with chlorophyll. Across the small backyard, he spies Lucy. Her straight skirt has been hiked fetchingly to allow her to take a seat on the worn steps of the gray wooden porch behind the house. Her eyes are closed, and her face raised adoringly to the sky. She looks like a young girl waiting to be kissed. A Seattleite struck dumb by the sight of sun, Seth remarks. Waking to him, she smiles wordlessly and lifts her far hand to reveal a cigarette. After Isaac, she lapsed, secretly. He didn't suspect until she started wheezing after their evening runs. Embarrassed to be caught now, She crushes the butt carefully under her heel and, as Lucy would, folds it into her palm for later disposal. Seth takes the step below her. They marvel momentarily about the day, the promise of blue skies.
I never said how wonderful your talk was, Seth. Your eulogy.
Yeah. Words. The fundamental medium of human exchange. They're great. And then what? I worried about Sarah. I was afraid she'd think I was profaning the sacred.
Sarah understands.
As much as I do.
Are you really all right with her plans?
Lucy asks.
I wouldn't be shocked if she stays with this.
Last night, Sarah, who has talked of grad school, even the rabbinate, told them that she and her boyfriend, Phil, have enrolled in an AmeriCorps program to train teachers for inner-city schools. They expect to stay here or somewhere else in the Middle West. Great by me. I'm proud of her. That she's that kind of person. I never expected her to become a columnist.
You seem to like the idea of her as a professor.
I've always loved intellectuals. They seem so distant and admirable to me. He thinks fleetingly of Sonny 25 years ago, his thrall with all that philosophy he couldn't really comprehend.
Your father was a professor,
Lucy says. This is Lucy, always on the nerve. How did he ever miss that? How? He stands to continue his inspection of the backyard. He offers Lucy his arm and she takes it, accompanying Seth as he ambles. This is always there. They like each other so much. Even as their life together has seemed in the last 2 years unfathomable, impossible, she remains the nicest human being he knows. In her mothering years, he lived in undying amazement of Lucy. She looked at every paper, bored in until she'd heard every question the teacher asked at school. She knew by heart what was on the lunch menu, the name of every friend, and whether she or he was a good influence, even if the kid had never set foot inside their home. She'd memorized every trumpet note or ballet turn. She hit the laundry room at 6 a.m., because she knew what clothes they'd want to wear, right down to the undies. Her children's lives were so thoroughly understood, digested, imagined, so thoroughly her own that other women often seemed to freeze over in shame. But all of that allowed Lucy to avoid wondering about herself. Coming here, seeing Sonny up there on the bench, so positive about what's right, sure about the fate of others, he realized again that was one of the things he wanted. Someone whose desires were less frightening to her than they are to Lucy, who is always somewhat oppressed by her need to please, and even past the age of 40 can look primitively pained by the question, "What do you want?" Isaac's death somehow fit in with that and drove him often to the point of rage. Didn't she know there was no accepting this, that it was not part of some universal harmonic? It made him crazy. Crazy because he was not enough, not big enough, positive enough, to give her what she required. He has often predicted to himself, in solitary moments when he thinks he's given up, that Lucy's next husband will be an oracle of some kind, a clergyman, a visionary. It was no accident she started out hooked up with the likes of Hobie. Are you holding up? He asks her, as they turn the outer boundary of the small yard. An old hedge here is gnarled at its joints with an arthritic thickness that brings to mind his father at the end.
I guess. I still find death amazing, don't you? It seems so contrary to all of my assumptions.
He smiles toughly. For him, it's always present now. You build a foothold in the world in the first half of life, and then watch it slip away. But he didn't mean to exchange philosophies. He was daring to ask about her life at present. Shortly after he left, Lucy took up with a 26-year-old, the associate director of the soup kitchen. But that fizzled. People, other women especially, were unbearably cruel. One neighbor asked Lucy if she was going to give Mo a graduation party when he finished school. She's lonely now, Sarah says. To that observation, Seth made no reply, even though he'll always feel the impulse to tell Sarah everything will be all right. He really didn't want his kids growing up in one of those screwed-up American fin de siècle families, where dad's married to his former secretary, a great gal for a transsexual, and mom is taking dope and sleeping with the bishop on the sly, and brother gets off handling snakes and robbing convenience stores, and everybody joins hands at Thanksgiving and says, "Thank God we have our family." He wanted his daughter and his son to know there was a true center, that some things are enduring and healing. And then, Isaac died. As they walk, as Seth thinks about these things, his mind turns to the piece he'll write tomorrow. His work is always with him, a part of him forever lodged in that mainframe in Seattle, where the man known in 167 daily papers as Michael Frayn seems to exist. That Michael, in Seth's mind's eye, has a somewhat distinct physical appearance, shorter than Seth, fuller in body, perpetually young, with a wry, unflappable expression, probably the physical self he idealized when he was, say, a freshman in high school and still thought anything was possible for him. The column he'll take up tomorrow is one of a half dozen he dredged from his months visiting his father in hospitals and rehab facilities. It's about marriage. The piece concerns a lean, bald-headed man from Kewanee who donated a kidney to his wife. Seth didn't know that was possible. He thought it was like bone marrow transplants, where you faced problems unless you were born with a twin. This man, an engineer at Dunning, a defense outfit, is not particularly articulate, not the kind of fellow who can say much about motives. But this couple now lies together in the same room in Sinai Cedars Hospital, getting different IVS drugs and the same painkillers, with matching 14-inch incisions on their left sides. It seems like an act from mythology, reaching inside yourself, an organ from him, now an organ in her, an echo of Adam's aboriginal rib. The magic of what Seth does is the interviews, asking people to account for things like that. He can be 1,500 miles away, no more than a voice on the phone, someone whom they know at best by reputation, and usually not at all, merely somebody trying to let his soul crawl down the line, saying, "I want to know you, would like to tell your story." And folks, in their hunger to be understood, will say almost anything. In his hospital bed, his hand bruised by the IVs, this man took a sip of water first. "Well," he told Seth in that slow Midwestern drawl, "well, it didn't really occur to me there was anything else I'd like to do." The line was a killer. Lucy and he once had that kind of autonomic commitment, and would still do anything for one another, he thinks, whether out of habit or gratitude or admiration. But listening to that man, he was suddenly unsure that what's growing up between Sonny and him will flower that fully. There's been peace, humor, sensitivity, and amazing sensuality. But he doubts Sonny, in the face of sacrifice, could ever really convince him there's nothing else she'd like to do. At Seth's feet lies the little corner of lawn his mother ripped away a generation ago to form a vegetable garden. She tilled this 15 square feet of soil relentlessly and made it yield remarkable things. Leaf lettuce first, then tomatoes, peas, pole beans. A huge zucchini somehow sprang up in the adjoining privet and was mistaken by the entire family when they spotted it for a raccoon. He can recall his father, terrified, edging up like a fencer with a rake extended. Seth remembers many Sundays out here, hoeing, weeding, being the man his mother needed, doing her gentle bidding while he tried to keep up with the trapper's game on his transistor. Lucy has wonderful vegetable gardens, and he's always adored her for them. His mother's gardening equipment was housed in the narrow barnwood shed his father positioned near the corner of this lot. Bernhard feared thieves, of course, A heavy, rusted padlock hangs there. Seth would love to look inside. What has my father left me? He thinks again. He heaves on the old wooden door, then recalls the key, still hidden under the same piece of loose walk. The interior is dark, smelling of rotted wood, of rancid fertilizers and loam. The old tools lie in disarray, the metal parts rough with rust. The spiders have choked each other in bleak, silky competition. Jeez, oh Pete, he says suddenly. What a horrible day this is. Behind the open door, safe from the wind and prying eyes, actually alone with Lucy for the first instant in months, he wordlessly accepts her comfort. Here she is, in the crook of his arm, this woman, this tiny female person whom he was with longer than he lived without her. Here she is.
Sunny. You aren't leaving. I hoped we'd get a chance to talk, Lucy says, as Sunny, carrying her purse, approaches the front door. It's a few minutes past 4:30 and most of the afternoon visitors have departed. Attempting to sound casual, Sunny explains she has to pick up Nikki from daycare a few minutes away and expects to return with her. Unmentioned is the fact that Seth performs this task many afternoons now. I'd love to get away for a second, says Lucy. How about I come along? As Lucy rushes off for her coat, Sunny indulges in an instant of stark assessment. Lucy is one of those women born in the right age. In the era of Botticelli and Rubens, her looks would have been disregarded. Yet at the end of the 20th century, her slender waifishness is right.